Tēnā koutou no mai, haere mai. Welcome to Q&A, I'm Jack Tay. Today, the government's plan to fast-track consents for dams, for roads and for mines.
We think the status quo is wrong, we're changing it. We're making it easy to do things. If people don't agree with that, well, they can throw us out in 3 years' time.
We will ask Labor's new finance spokesperson about her interest in tax and the downfall of the Roman Empire. And for all the chat about China's influence, we look at another country's curious approach to diplomacy in the Pacific.
That was joyous. We were dancing, which is our legacy as Indigenous people. And I think it was important for Jerusalem to have a celebration during this time.
We'll have that story for you shortly. But first, housing affordability is arguably the single most pressing economic, social and cultural problem facing the government. Those are the words of the new housing minister, Chris Bishop, as he pushes forward with his plan to turbo boost the housing supply around the country. The minister has set a target for housing affordability over the long term, and I sat down with him late this week and began by asking about his plans for social housing.
Do you accept the total number of social houses available will need to grow beyond what has already been funded and planned in order to meet the demand?
Yes. How I do accept more? That. Well, there's 25,000 people on the wait list right now, 25,000 applicants on the wait list. Not all of those people will come off the wait list into a social house. Some will go into private rentals. Some will self-select off the wait list altogether. We need more social housing. If you look at New Zealand in terms of social housing relative to, say, many other countries, over time our numbers have gone down. We need to lift that up. We're doing some work on that at the moment as to how much that needs to grow by. We will add more places over time to the places that the government funds for social housing. The difference between us and the last government is that we're much more agnostic about who owns the house.
Right, so you're supporting, like, CHIPS, the community housing providers, as opposed to simply building.
Yes, and so what we can do from a government point of view is we fund the place, the social housing provider, which could be Kāinga Ora, or it could be a community housing provider like Emerge or the Salvation Army. They take the money for the place. They can then borrow against that funding stream, go out and get private finance from a range of different things. Sometimes it's actually philanthropic capital, and there's a lot of people, the Tyndall Foundation, for example, involved in funding this. They take the funding stream. They can then bank that and go and use that money to build more, build actual physical homes. We're much more into that model than the last government, which basically funneled a lot of money to Kāinga Ora and... We've got that under review because we're not confident they did a particularly good job of building houses with that money.
So if we look forward over the next 18 months or so, should we expect you to fund the actual building of houses beyond June of 2025?
Well, I'm not going to get ahead of budget decisions. The current funding track that we committed to in the election is for the social housing track through to June 2025. I'm not going to get ahead of budget discussions. But what I can say at a general level is we need to grow social housing supply in New Zealand, but there's a range of ways to do that.
You said this week you want to end the blight that is emergency housing. That was the word you chose. And part of that means increasing scrutiny of those who are applying for emergency housing grants. What evidence do you have that undeserving people are accessing emergency housing grants at the moment?
Yeah, so for us, fundamentally, it's about rights and responsibilities. So obviously there will always be a place for the government to provide emergency housing for people who need it. When it started life under the last National Government in 2016-2017, it started life as a short-term measure. You know, the government gives you a grant, a voucher, you take it.
So my question then, so what evidence do you have that undeserving people are accessing those grants at the moment?
Anecdotal feedback from the community and from MSD, but also from the community.
Anecdotal feedback?
Yeah, well, look, this is a tough area, right? This is a really, really tough area. We've had advice from...
So what percentage of emergency housing grants are denied at the moment? Do you know that?
Not many. From memory, in the last year, about 2,500, 2,600, something like that, over 100,000.
Yeah, but that is still quite a few, isn't it?
Well, in relation to the overall number of 100,000, 120,000 grants given, you know, 3,000 families there right now. Numbers have come back a bit recently, but 3,000 families, average length of stay is 26 weeks. Not many are declined. We're just saying to MSD, yep, you should have the support available if people need it. But you do need to ask a few questions of people, like, are there other places you can stay? Going to a motel should not be the kind of first choice for people who need support.
Do you not think the MSD asks that at the moment?
They do, technically. We're asking them to really invigilate people a bit more to make sure that we're providing taxpayer support to people who really need support.
You've said that you won't be supporting people who have, quote, unreasonably contributed to their emergency housing need. What does that mean?
Unfortunately, there are a group of people who abuse their rights and privileges when it comes to emergency housing. They trash the place, for example, and people watching.
This is people who are applying for grants in the first place, and if they've unreasonably contributed to their emergency housing need,
people have to reapply, right? That's the thing, is people often the grants are for, say, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. People have to reapply.
And you've shortened that window now, too.
And we're going to shorten that window, yes.
So just to be clear, though, so if someone has unreasonably contributed to their emergency housing need, you're talking about someone who's already in emergency housing or in social housing and has trashed the place.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are a group of people who do that, and there'll be people watching this morning who will have seen that in their own communities, and it's tragic. But the taxpayer at some point has to say, look, we're not just going to keep funding you to trash motel rooms and live in squalor. I don't think New Zealanders would accept that.
So where do those people go?
Well, ultimately, they will have to go and bunk with friends and family. And that's what some people do now.
But wouldn't they have done that when MSD had given them the greater scrutiny that you're introducing?
Well, theoretically, and hope, you know, that's what we want to try
so
and get to.
So they only get emergency housing if they don't have anyone to stay with.
We want to make it genuinely a last resort. We want to make sure that people accessing emergency housing, it's there as the final port of call for people who actually need it.
My question is, what happens to those people for whom it is a last resort, who you say have unreasonably contributed to their emergency housing need by trashing it, for example?
There'll always be support for people who need it. The New Zealand government is not going to sit around.
That's not my question, though. I get that, but you're saying that people who don't respect the roof over their heads, funded by the taxpayer, should not expect to continue having that support. So my question is, where do those people go?
At the most basic level, there may well be people who miss out on emergency housing support. We are tightening the eligibility.
And so where do they go?
Well, they will have to find an alternative place to stay, but the taxpayer at some point has to say,
what's an alternative
we're not funding
place to stay?
Your bad lifestyle choices.
I understand. What's an alternative place to stay?
Friends and family. That's what people do now, and that option becomes available.
They only get emergency housing if they don't have friends or family. That's the scrutiny that you're introducing.
Well, not necessarily. At the moment, the status quo, these changes
we're
are happening.
We're going around in circles.
But these changes are happening contemporaneously.
These are the rules and settings that you are applying.
Well, we're going to strengthen. So theoretically, these things exist right now, right? Mm. We're going to strengthen all of these eligibility checks and all of these verification checks at the same time. I think it's what New Zealanders would expect.
You are allowing councils to opt out of the medium density residential standards, which of course you previously supported in a bipartisan accord, so long as those councils provide for 30 years of housing growth. Mm. Can you give us a definition around that? What exactly is 30 years of housing growth?
We're working through that right now, and I'm taking a bit of time to get that right.
Because that definition's critical, right?
Absolutely. That's why we're taking the time to get it right. The definition's really important because we want to live zone 30 years of immediate growth, flood the market with development opportunities, drive down land prices at the edge of a city and inside cities. So we're just taking the time to get that right. I've got a group of extremely smart people working on it, and I'm not quite ready to announce it
when do you think you will?
Oh, very soon, in the next couple of months.
Right, before the budget?
Yes, before the budget. It's important because a lot of changes hinge on that definition. Yes. We get the 30 years right, we make the medium density standards optional, and all the councils are going through their plan change processes at the moment, Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, and so there's a lot of interest in that.
The reason I ask is both Auckland and Christchurch say at the moment their urban plans already allow for 30 years of growth. Mm. So is there a possibility we will actually see no changes in our two biggest cities?
I'm taking advice on that.
But that's a possibility?
I think it's unlikely that would be the case. We want many more development opportunities in Auckland and Christchurch, and most particularly we want more opportunities in Wellington, which has a real housing shortage. Yeah. So we're just working that through. The Auckland situation is a bit more challenging because they've got the flood response from last year and also the last government excluded a massive section of the rezoning for the Auckland Light Rail project, which, of course, is not happening anymore.
But looking at the unitary plan in Auckland, for example, so their forecast demand in terms of dwellings up to 2051, so almost 30 years, was up to 384,000 dwellings. An analysis of the unitary plan 2 years ago found it allowed for more than 900,000 dwellings.
Yes.
If every single section is developed to its absolute maximum.
Yes.
So that's the critical point, right? Under the current unitary plan, you could make an argument that actually Auckland doesn't need to change a thing.
There's 2 points there. One is forecast demand for the next 30 years, and of course, what about the demand that we haven't met for the last 30 years, which has led us to the housing affordability crisis that we have? And then, the second point
is 900,000 dwellings. 900,000 dwellings is 4 million people, right?
Yeah, but we need to go above and beyond what the forecast demand is over the next 30 years.
Forecast demand over 30 years isn't 4 million people.
But that's how you drive down land prices.
I understand, but you'd have to go a long way beyond the forecast demand. I mean, 900,000 dwellings under the current unitary plan.
You're raising a completely legitimate point, and we're working that through. My policy goal is to have hundreds of thousands of development opportunities for people to build at the fringe of the city and at the edge of the city, and let the development economics dictate where development takes place rather than artificial planning rules around what takes place.
Will there be anything to stop councils from focusing that 30 years of housing supply in neighbourhoods that are a long way from city centres?
Again, we're looking at that. It may be that we take a graduated approach so that they have to open up some greenfields land, but they also have to open up some land closer to the city.
Tell us more about that. Yeah, what would a graduated approach look like? An appropriate balance?
We're looking at that. At the fringe, it's really important that we smash the metropolitan urban limit in Auckland. Auckland has to grow out. And the evidence from the Infrastructure Commission, for example, is that the price differential between land on the outside of the zone and the inside of the zone is extremely big. Those land differential prices flow through to apartments in Auckland City. So people pay more for an apartment in Auckland City because we haven't zoned land at the fringe of the city.
Right.
The economic evidence on that is really clear.
But there are also a whole heap of relatively wealthy suburbs right next to the city centre that haven't been developed.
Yes, that's true. The unitary plan does a lot in that respect. The point you made before, you're right about that. There's more that can be done. But equally, we've also heard the message from some communities in Auckland that they want the council to have more discretion and flexibility about that. That's not just an Auckland issue. There's other communities too.
You have set some relatively loose targets for housing affordability over the long term. What advice have you had about the impact of your landlord tax cuts on house prices?
The advice we've had in relation to rent affordability is that it puts downward pressure on
rents. House prices, though, not rents, house prices.
I haven't had specific advice on house price, the impact on house prices.
You have had no advice on what those big changes will do to house prices?
I haven't had specific advice on that.
Shouldn't you have had advice on that?
Well, the way the paper flow works is it's essentially a finance paper, so I haven't had, as Housing Minister, specific advice about that. I have seen advice around bringing back interest deductibility for landlords will put downward pressure on rents.
On rents.
And that's important because rental affordability is a big driver of the waitlist.
So what would be your expectation as to what it'll do to house prices? You think it'll bring rents down, but what will it do to house prices?
The ultimate driver of house prices is supply and demand of housing. And
so you don't think that changing this policy will have any impact?
Well, I think it may incentivise more residential construction for the purpose of rental properties. That is ultimately a good thing for rental affordability, and that's what I'm very focused on.
Won't it also just incentivise housing as an investment?
Well, ultimately what we want to do across the housing, our housing system...
Will it incentivise housing as an investment class?
I don't believe so. Because what we're doing is returning to basic principles of tax law, which is that interest is an expense that you can deduct against your income.
I understand the changes. Is it more lucrative for landlords to have interest deductibility in place or not to have it in place?
Well, clearly it is better for landlords to have interest deductibility in place, and that is why we think,
So this change makes housing as an investment class more lucrative?
It's partly why we want to do it, because we need mum and dad landlords in the market, right? A lot of them have exited the market post the interest deductibility changes.
So you would accept then that it makes it more lucrative as an investment class?
Well, yes, on the margins, yes.
How much is it going to cost, those policies?
Well, you'll wait and see when the announcements are made.
Wait and see?
I'm not the finance minister. You'll have to wait and
you
see.
You are the housing minister.
I am, but this is fundamentally a tax issue, and I'm not trying to dodge the question. I'm just saying not for me to announce that.
You have set targets for housing affordability in New Zealand. So I've got one last question then. The median house price as it stands in New Zealand is about 6.6 times the median household income. So relative to incomes, will house prices in New Zealand be more or less expensive at the end of this parliamentary term?
At the end of 2026, I'm not going to make a prediction or forecast that. In the medium to long term.
What's your target, though?
Well, as I said publicly, and I said to you on the Q&A
You've given me the long term target. Yep, so I'm asking for the target for this parliamentary term. Should houses be more or less expensive relative to household incomes than they are today?
I want them to be more affordable. Whether or not that actually happens is a different issue. There's a range of things going on. We're in a construction sector downturn at the moment. The OCR's been cranked up. People are finding it hard to get finance. We're in a downturn. The construction sector is cyclical, including in residential.
Where the targets go?
Yeah, well, where the targets government. I've set a target. In the medium to long term, I want house prices to be
tangible marker so that we can actually assess your progress over the term that you're in government.
In the next 24 months, I'm not willing to do that because it's a cyclical market and we're in a cyclical type time. And in the medium to long term, I want house prices to be about 3 to 5 times household income. That would make New Zealand housing more affordable and that would have a transformative effect on the New Zealand economy.
After the break, the balance between environmental concerns and driving economic growth in the new bill, which could see coal mines fast-tracked. Kia ora Eddie, we welcome back to Q&A. After repealing its predecessor's resource management reforms, the government has introduced a bill to establish what it calls a one-stop shop for consenting big projects of national or regional significance. But critics say the fast-tracking process risks environmental catastrophe. After the bill passed its first reading under urgency, I asked Chris Bishop what he's hoping to achieve.
We want to unclog the country from the red and green tape that's holding it back. If you look at the evidence from the Infrastructure Commission, for example, we spend $1.3 billion a year on resource consents. From 2014 to 2019, the time it took to get a resource consent for infrastructure doubled. Way too long. We all pay the cost of that, by the way. And so this is about unclogging the system, making it easier to do things, more aquaculture, more housing, more renewable energy, more infrastructure, more roads, more public transport, getting those consents up and running so that investors can make those decisions and get them built.
So in real terms, just give us a sense as to the kinds of projects that could be approved under the fast-tracking legislation. Fish farms, yes?
Yes.
New dams?
Yes.
New roads?
Yes.
Seabed mining?
Possibly. If there's an application, possibly.
Coal mines?
Yes.
In a country as environmentally precious and fragile as New Zealand, what are the potential downsides to fast-tracking those kinds of consents?
Well, I don't accept the binary that you can either have the economy or the environment. I think you can actually do both.
It's a balance, right? That's the argument, you think this strikes a better balance. But there are still potential downsides, and so I want to know that in a country like New Zealand, what are those potential downsides,
well,
as you see them?
I mean, I just reject...
The downsides that you are weighing up.
Well, I just reject the binary, right? Like, you can do projects that impact the environment while still protecting the environment. Mm. You can build a new road and make sure you take account of the environmental impacts of that new road. Actually, renewable energy is a classic where the binary just doesn't exist. Building a wind farm has an environmental impact. Building a dam for a hydro scheme has an environmental impact.
Yeah, but I mean the balance
was... But also, it lowers carbon emissions.
Yeah.
You know, and decarbonisation, I mean, the last government declared a climate emergency and made it bloody impossible to build a wind farm.
Yeah, I'm not looking at the way they were running things, but it is a significant shift in terms of
it
the balance
definitely a
between...
Shift.
When you are trying to strike that balance, I want to get a really good appreciation of your understanding as to what the most significant downsides are.
Well, the downsides are, I think, relatively obvious to everybody, which is that, depending on the scope and nature of the project, there will be an impact on the environment. But it's all about how you mitigate that, how you limit that, take account of the effects of an environmental project. A wind farm has a different impact on the environment compared to a coal mine, for example. Hydro, different to building a new road. Depends on the individual circumstance and the individual project.
So under the previous government's fast-tracking scheme, an expert panel had the final say on which projects were ultimately put forward for the fast-tracking process. Ministers didn't make that call. It was up to the panel to make that call. But under your regime, you're going to have a similar advisory group putting forward the projects that might go ahead for fast-tracking. But ministers are going to have the ultimate discretion. They're going to have the final say.
Ministers refer the projects to the expert panel. The expert panel applies the conditions and the various limits that the project will have to meet. And then the final decision-making goes back to ministers.
So hang on. It is ministers who decide which projects are up for the fast-tracking consent in the first place,
correct,
as opposed to an expert panel.
Correct.
Why should ministers have that discretion?
Well, that was the status quo under the last government as well. So the last government actually legislated 17 projects to go into the fast track. We've set up an independent panel to provide us advice on what projects should go into the bill to start with, and we've replicated their expert panel model when it comes to the conditions.
And that panel who put forward the projects to go into the bill to start with, they don't make the call, right? Ultimately, the minister makes the call as to which projects are accepted.
The last government picked 17 projects, put them in the bill. They automatically got referred to the expert panel to apply the conditions, and then they made the decisions whether or not it went ahead or not. Mm. We've kept the expert panel bit. We've said in relation to the projects that get immediate fast track as part of the parliamentary process, we're going to have an independent panel, independent expert group to provide the advice on that. Mm. But the final decision-making authority with this, you're completely correct, as ministers.
Yeah. Did the last government list the projects that were going ahead with fast-tracking for the first reading of the bill publicly?
Yes, they did. It was in the COVID-19 fast-track amendment bill 2020, I think it was passed.
Will your government commit to doing the same before it goes to Select Committee?
Well, it's already gone to Select Committee. So what we're going to do is run an independent process through an expert advisory group, and then we will put the projects into the bill later as part of the parliamentary process.
Is the answer.
We're considering whether or not we should have that list available to the Select Committee, but I'd actually rather the Select Committee focus its time on getting the bill right. It's a very complicated piece of legislation, a lot of details to get right across Public Works, Conservation Act, Wildlife Act, RMA. This is a one-stop shop, so it's not just the RMA, it's a whole suite of legislation.
So just to be clear, though, the previous government publicly listed the projects for fast-tracking when it went to Select Committee.
Yes.
Your government is not doing that. Is that democratic?
Well, I think it's completely legitimate. Actually, what we're doing is going through a transparent process. I mean, how did those 17 projects make its way into the bill last time? No one actually knows. Basically, the government just went around and found some projects.
But the public had the say, had some say through the Select Committee process.
Yeah, well,
this time the public's just stumbling around in the dark. We have absolutely no idea what kind of projects are going
to
be.
I'd argue we're running a more transparent process in the sense that we're getting an independent group to have a look at it, separate from ministers. They'll provide the advice to ministers. But as I say, we're considering whether or not we should put that project list before the committee so that people can have a say on that. So I'm not ruling that out. I think I hear what you're saying, and there's a legitimate point around that. The issue is that I've got is that the Select Committee will become overwhelmed by the projects rather than the mechanism of the law itself. But we're just working that through, so I'm not ruling it out.
Will projects that were previously rejected by the courts be eligible for fast-tracking?
Yes, they will. That will be over to applicants. And there also may be situations where people have current resource consents through that are partway through the process, that may wish to withdraw and resubmit through the fast-track process. That'll be over to the applicants.
Is it appropriate for ministers to use ministerial discretion to essentially overrule judicial decisions?
Well, we're trying to change the system. I make no apologies for it. We are deliberately disrupting the system. The status quo is failing New Zealand. It just is. It costs too much to do things. It takes too much time. It costs too much money. It's holding New Zealand back. We were elected as a government on a mandate to do things, to make it easier to get geothermal up and running, more wind, more housing, more mines, more aquaculture. We make no apologies for it. This is deliberately designed to disrupt the system.
And what if it goes wrong? What if you make the wrong call? What if you give something a consent that would not otherwise have got a consent and it causes who knows what kind of environmental damage?
I think there will be projects that will be granted consent that would not otherwise have got a consent under the status quo. Frankly, I hope that's the case, because that's why we're doing it.
And my question is, what if it goes wrong? What if you, as minister, exercising discretion, make the wrong call and it ends up causing massive environmental damage?
Ultimately, the public will be able to judge the performance of the government in late 2026. That's how our democracy works. We're putting our cards on the table. We think the status quo is wrong, we're changing it. We're making it easy to do things. If people don't agree with that, well, they can throw us out in 3 years' time.
Why isn't the Minister for the Environment able to make any decisions here?
Because this is primarily an economic development statute. So it's the Minister for Infrastructure, which is currently me. Mm. Shane Jones is Regional Development and Transport, which is Simeon Brown.
Doesn't impact environment.
Of course it impacts the environment, but the
coal
permits,
mines,
sure, but
seabed
the,
mining.
But we're not... How those things are managed, the impact on the environment is being dealt with by the expert panel.
So they're
the experts.
What environmental credentials will that expert panel have?
Oh, so we're replicating the same structure that the current fast track has set up by the last government. So I will appoint the panel convener, which has to be a High Court judge or an environment court judge. Mm-hmm. The panel convener then assembles the expert panels, and the expert panels have to have... There has to be essentially the RMA experts, so they're practiced in environmental law. We've also put a requirement in there around credentials with Maori issues, for example, tikanga as well.
Right. So if that panel comes to you and says, "Yep, you can grant the consent with all of these conditions," a minister can then push back, right, and say, "No, there are too many conditions on this."
Correct.
So what's the point in having a panel? If a minister can exercise ultimate discretion, what's the point?
The point of having the panel is to go through the project and the impacts on the environment and work out the ways in which there may be limits on what they can do. They have to take account of various different things.
And then
that's
they have
a highly technical process.
Yeah, right, and then they have a minister come in after that highly technical process and go, "Nah, sorry, this isn't good enough for me, remove some of these restrictions."
We've built that in because we are concerned that there potentially will be situations where the conditions imposed are too onerous. Mm. And I'd give you the example of the Mount Messenger Bypass project, for example, where NZTA... in perpetuity is spending an inordinate sum of money on environmental mitigation as a result of a process imposed by the Environment Court. We're keen to avoid situations where the conditions are so onerous that it makes the project unviable. And so that's just essentially a backstop to make sure that ministers can
unless,
say,
of course,
actually,
it's unviable
go back
for
again.
A reason. Right. Yeah. Since becoming the minister, have you had any contact with lobbyists who represent clients who want projects included in that fast track process?
I've had a range of emails and I think some formal letters from people lobbying for projects. I suspect a
Will
lot
you
of ministers
to making those
have.
Public?
If people OAA them, they'll be made public. I mean, there's been a lot. That's partly why we set up the independent process, because I wanted a situation where there was a good analytical assessment of the projects and how regionally significant they were and how nationally significant they were, and I wanted a situation where ministers didn't make those decisions in an ad hoc way before the bill got introduced. I wanted to set up a process where there was an independent panel running the ruler over those projects and providing formal advice to us. So I've deliberately set up the system to make sure it's a clean and clear, transparent
does
process.
Fast-tracking, does enabling this fast-tracking legislation incentivise lobbyists?
I'm not necessarily that's correct. I mean, there's lobbying on projects and on laws all the time.
Then why have you had so many emails?
Well, because when we announced that in late January, early February, I announced our intention to introduce a fast track regime. A lot of people are very excited about it because it's very hard to do things
so
in New Zealand.
So it does incentivise lobbying?
Well, people are excited about fast track. There's people out there who want to use the law, sure. So I suppose in that sense, that's true. There are people who want to use the law. But, you know, lobbying is not illegal and it's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing?
Well, lobbying is part and parcel of democracy. When people email their MP, they're lobbying them. Mm. When people ask for meetings to discuss a local project, that's lobbying. When Greenpeace sends stuff in telling me that I'm the scourge and the devil and they don't like me, that's lobbying.
So that's democracy. So then, in the interest of democracy, as a member of the public, if I have environmental concerns about a project going ahead, once you've committed it to the fast-track process, will I have an opportunity to come forward and make a submission?
Not as a member of the general public to the expert panel.
So the lobbyists can get in there. That's democracy.
No, they don't. So the expert panels, be really clear, the expert panels apply the conditions.
I understand that.
The people who go through that are the panellists, who are the environmental experts, the applicants themselves, and people who have a connection to the project who are affected by it. So if you're building a wind farm next door, for example, or...
But a member of the public with environmental concerns about a new coal mine going up can't come forward and say, actually, I'm going to make a formal submission on this.
Not to the expert panel, no. Because the point of the expert panel is to deal with the conditions upon which a project happens, rather than stopping the project in the first place. And so, no. Yeah. Greenpeace don't get to influence the expert panel.
Finally.
Or Forest and Bird, or any other agency group.
That was Chris Bishop. Hey, we had to snip a couple of minutes out of the interview, but you can see the whole thing and all of our interviews on YouTube. Just search NZ Q&A and we will pop right up. After the break, she's a mother of 8 kids, a former Beehive staffer, and was inspired to become a tax lawyer in part by the fall of the Roman Empire. Labour's new finance spokesperson certainly has the hype, but does she have the vision? Kia ora te, we welcome back. As former Finance Minister Grant Robertson prepares to leave Parliament, his replacement is getting ready to debate one of the most consequential government budgets in recent history. Barbara Edmonds is a former tax lawyer and a parliamentary staffer to both Labour and National MPs. She is now the MP for Mana and Labour's finance spokesperson. Talofa, welcome to the show.
Talofa lover.
Michael Woodhouse said that you told him you wanted to be the head of a government agency one day. Why did you become a politician instead?
So in 2017, Labour came into the Beehive, and when Labour came in, I saw a reflection of New Zealand for the people that worked for them. I was, I've been a long time Labour voter, but for me, the values that Labour shares are the same values that I've shared and been brought up in around looking after other people, ensuring that the government provides safety nets, and so it was very much a natural fit.
Okay, that's why you joined Labour, but why did you become a politician?
So I've worked in my community of Porirua for a while. Obviously, having 8 kids, you get widely involved in lots of things. Mm. One of the first reasons why I got into board governing, which is a part of the local school, was I saw a kid walking home from school on a rainy day. They only had T-shirt and shorts, and they had jandals. Mm. And for me, I just thought, well, I've got 8 children. They're really fortunate. They've got a warm, dry home. They've got parents that look after them. You know, I've been brought up in a benefit-dependent household myself, and I was fortunate I had a father that did the same thing. So for me, it's really much about looking after other kids, because sometimes other kids don't have the same opportunities that my own children have.
Yeah, talk to us about that a little bit more. What does being the mum of 8, which I'm sure everyone always brings up with you, what does that teach you about the equality of opportunity in New Zealand?
That it's not necessarily always there for others. And that's not just because I'm a mother of 8, but that's also because of my upbringing and my background. My mother passed away when I was 4. My dad was age 40 and had to look after 4 children by himself. He was able to do that because there was a benefit system that he could depend on so he could spend some time to look after me and my siblings.
Could he do that today?
Be really difficult for him to do so.
Well, you guys have been in government for the last 6 years. Yeah. Why is that?
It's difficult because the cost of living is higher. They were really fortunate. They were able to capitalise their family scheme benefit and have a house that they lived in. So it is going to be difficult times for families. And so I know that for Labour, we had a focus on reducing child poverty, and we could have done a lot more. But it's just, I think it would be harder for families.
What you could have done a lot more. Tell me about that. What could you have done?
So the indexation of benefits, for example, to wage growth rather than inflation. And we just did that in the last couple of years. You know, possibly we could have done it earlier. But again, there's for us, lunches in schools, free period products, half price transport fares. Those were the things that we put into place to try and help families with their everyday cost of living.
You've seen the latest child poverty stats, though, that they are poor. What else could you have done?
I think there's it's basically a lot of the reason why I'm taking my time with this is because I look back to the welfare working group, and I think about, at the time, ministers had to make a judgment around what recommendations they could do and at what time. You know, I back them in the time that they've had to basically phase in some of those recommendations. But at the same time, we also had to invest in other parts of government systems. So I do believe that the ministers had to do with the best that they had at the time.
Sure, but with the benefit of hindsight, should Labour ministers in the last government have acted upon more of the recommendations from the Welfare Expert Advisory Group?
I think we would always say yes. You know, we would always want to do better and do more. And unfortunately, we got voted out and weren't able to carry that work on.
So which of those recommendations do you think stands out as one that perhaps should have been acted on that wasn't?
Yeah, so I think that indexation possibly could have done it earlier, but again, you've got to look at the books at the time that they made those decisions, and then they did do it.
I get it. You're saying that they made the best decisions they could with the information they had at the time, the political situation they were in at the time. What else, though? What else could they have done from the WEAG recommendations?
So I think some of the, you know, obviously there has been some discussions around a universal basic income, you know, around the in-work tax credit. So those are some of the things which I know ministers were trying to look at, trying to get some advice on. So there's different views in it, and so for me it's now I've got to be able to look forward so that in 2026 when we come in, what are the things we need to pick up and we need to improve on.
So would you support the introduction of universal basic income?
That's something that our party hasn't worked through yet, and it's something that I'd need
principle.
To talk to our team.
Yeah, of course. In principle, though, as the finance spokesperson, is it the sort of thing you would support?
It's kind of, and this is me, you know, there are pros and cons to any sort of policy decision when it comes to that. So you would say, okay, if you put in the universal basic income, what does that mean for working poor families? You know, which is quite targeted. You know, what is the money that you have basically in the hand to deal with the sorts of problems? So for me, I'm not yet of a position whether I would or not. And again, I'm subject to our party process and we'll just work through that.
I just want to ask you some really basic questions about our economy and tax system. As it stands, is our tax system fair?
Depends on who you talk to.
What do you think?
And for me, I believe that we do have some bases that we should be taxing.
What are those bases?
If you look at capital gains, you know, for some people we do have some elements of capital that is taxed and some that isn't. So for me, I believe that we need to have a really good look at it. You know, there have been a number of tax working groups over the years.
So in principle, would you support a comprehensive capital gains tax? You as the party spokesperson, not necessarily as the party, I understand there's a process that we have to go through, but would you as party spokesperson in principle support a comprehensive capital gains tax?
And again, it comes down to a definition. Being a tax lawyer, what is a comprehensive capital gains?
Well, we're not talking about a bright line, we're talking about say you tax all capital gains from property sales, not including the family home.
But that's not a comprehensive capital gains tax.
Okay, for businesses as well. All capital gains are being taxed. Would you support that?
So we have you look at to where the tax working group said, right? They basically said too hard around valuation for businesses, too hard around art pieces, you know, jewellery pieces. So they said you should look at a capital gains tax, but, you know, keeping aside the residential family home. For me, I'm an absolute team player. And for me, where our Labor team goes to and where we decide, that's what I'm going to be doing.
Is it fair that wages are taxed, but many capital gains aren't?
Yeah, and that goes to that, you know, the South Auckland cleaner or the Porirua security guard. You know, for them, every dollar that they earn in their wages and salaries is taxed. But in other ways, but for other people, they might not have the wages and salaries.
So is that fair?
No. So for me, and again, going to work through that as a Labor team and see where we get to.
Is it fair that our income tax thresholds haven't been adjusted for 14 years?
I wouldn't say it's unfair or not fair. It's just the decisions that politicians had to make at the time.
So you don't have a view on whether that's fair?
For me, I'm going to have a look at it with the team and see where we get to in relation to that. I know National, that's what they're going to be doing. The difficulty for any future governments when they come in is reversing such changes. So they're going to be coming through with that, and we're going to have a decision as to, you know, whether we carry that on or not. But for me, it's something that we've got to work through again.
In principle, did you support the wealth tax as put forward by David Parker and Grant Robertson?
Unlike some of my tax colleagues, I mean, my former ministerial colleagues, I'm not going to comment on those sort of discussions.
Why not? Well, why don't we deserve to know, given the prominence of this role, why don't we as the voting public deserve to know what your personal position is on this? I think we can all appreciate the complexity of coming up with policies as a party. We know that within caucus you all need to have conversations. Yep. Various people need to, have those debates within caucus. But I think we still deserve to know what your position is.
And my position is, again, I'm a team player. And, you know, those are the rules that were part of Cabinet confidentiality, and I'm going to stick to them.
How are you different from Grant Robertson? How does your ethos in this portfolio differ from the former finance minister?
I do want to acknowledge Grant, right? I've been working with him and together with the Labor team for, you know, 6 years they were in government. I wouldn't wish upon any finance minister the decisions that he had to make. You know, when COVID hit, 2 weeks into it, I was seconded to the operational command centre for COVID. My very first meeting was, how many body bags do we have in the country? and how many do we have on order?
Yeah.
You know, those are the choices that Grant, the advice that he was receiving, that he had to make a decision. If we're going to support this health response, how do we then ensure that people have still got a job when we come
out of
it?
So how does your ethos in this portfolio differ from his?
I think it's very similar to Grant.
Doesn't differ at all?
Yeah, well, it's really similar. It's massive shoes to fill, but I wear heels, you know, and I've got a different perspective in the sense that life perspective and that, you know, again, being brought up on a benefit, yeah.
Do you accept that the previous government's spending and stimulus decisions, even if they felt they made the best decisions they could with the information they had available at the time, ultimately contributed to inflation?
They made the best decisions they could at the time. It's so easy to be able to look back and to say, oh, we should have done this, or the Reserve Bank should have done this, but that was the decision they had to make at the time.
I understand it. So do you accept that the decisions they made at the time ultimately contributed to inflation?
I think the decisions they made at the time were the best ones that they could.
That's not what I asked, though. Yeah. Did the decisions they made at the time, with the best information they had available to them, ultimately contribute to inflation?
I believe it does. I mean, obviously, we've come to an inflationary impact, but again, that's not just decisions they make on their own, and it was decisions that they made based on the best information they had at the time.
How much do you think it contributed to inflation?
I don't know the answer to that. And it's one of those things that, you know, again, I don't want to look back. We've got books that are going to be open in May, September, December. Those are basically the vision that we need to look for going forward.
Do you think the previous government's economic policies contributed to Labor's loss at the election?
People just didn't feel inspired by what we were putting on the table, and they voted us out.
So is that a yes?
Yeah, they didn't feel inspired by what we were giving, and those are the economic policies. You know, it's economic policy, it's health policy, educational policy, and the election result showed that.
Does it make sense to carve out exceptions for GST?
I would say, as the pure tax lawyer, we've had a GST system since 1986. We've had massive technology changes since then. So at the time, you know, having carve-outs back then, having a nice, simple GST system, that's basically why we're world-leading.
Yeah.
At the time, we made a call that basically we were living in a cost-of-living crisis. We needed to try and support our people and our communities, and so we made that call to take GST off revenue.
So if we are in what could be deemed more normal times, does it make sense to carve out any exceptions for GST?
I think it's a decision every government has to look at. You know, it's not something that you just say, that's what we decided in 1986 and we shouldn't go forward with. But again, having a look at the books, you've got to figure out how you pay for that.
Which country's approach to tax, governments and economic growth do you most admire?
To be fair, I would say that we have a really good system here. This is the tax system that I know that I've spent a lot of time in my career in. You could say, you know, this is more the society we would like with our Nordic countries, or, you know, you could say, let's have a look at the way that Singapore does things. But ultimately, I do believe we have a generally robust tax system, and there will be things that need to be improved.
Do you read economic theory?
A little bit.
Who do you like? Who do you admire?
At the moment, I've got Jean Tirole on my desk at the moment, so I'm working through that. I also, you know, economic theory is also...
Sounds very la-di-da, you know what I mean.
the thing is with economics, right, I always look through economics and look at people. So it may not necessarily just be the economic theory textbooks that you read, you know. I'm also reading a Harvard University book around tax, the history of tax. So there's a lot of different books that I read, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's just the economist one.
Last question, give us 20 seconds on this, which I know isn't easy. What does tax policy have to do with the demise of the Roman Empire, since you're apparently inspired to study tax because of it?
Yeah, so when I was going through law school, I was also doing some ancient history papers. And basically, Emperor Justinian, it was the fall of the Roman Empire because basically they had to overtax people to pay for the wars and for the fires. So ultimately, the lesson I learned from that is if you overtax people, then you basically, well, in Justinian's case, broke down an empire.
Curious. Thank you very much. Good luck in your portfolio.
Thank you.
Labor's finance spokesperson, Barbara Edmonds. If you want to contact the Q&A team, please kōrero mai. These are our main platforms. You can send us an email, you can find us on X or on Facebook. After the break, we hear a lot about China's growing influence in our region, but it is not the only country looking for mates in the Pacific. In the ongoing battle for influence in the Pacific, a new contender has emerged. While much of the attention is focused on China and the US, Israel's steady campaign to win friends is starting to deliver results, Indira Stewart reports.
We would like to welcome you all to the opening of the very first Indigenous Embassy of Israel.
The opening of Israel's first Indigenous Embassy in February, posted on YouTube by the Friends of Zion Museum, featuring clips of Israel's ambassador to New Zealand and the Pacific being welcomed on Waitangi grounds. An initiative co-founded by Māori academic Dr. Cherie Trotter, a pro-Israel activist and now the director of this embassy in Israel, supported by Pacific Indigenous leaders from around the world.
We went as Indigenous people from the nations to stand with Jerusalem and to say to them, we acknowledge you as the Indigenous people of the land.
Dr. Ate Moala says she was there representing the people of Tonga with the blessing of Tonga's queen, Nana Sipa'u Tuku Aho.
She wanted to send her blessing and her prayers in support of Israel. So that was a privilege for me to send the blessing of the queen and the people of Tonga in Jerusalem.
Yeah. Dr. Moala, an outspoken activist and a devout Christian, says she was proud to celebrate Israel's Indigenous Embassy.
There was joyous. We were dancing, which is our legacy as Indigenous people. And I think it was important for Jerusalem to have a celebration during this time. It was wonderful.
And while there was dancing and singing in Jerusalem, in Gaza, the Israel military launched more strikes in response to the October 7th Hamas attack, pushing the death toll to more than 27,000, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The ongoing conflict revealing staunch support from Pacific governments for Israel. On October 27th, multiple Pacific countries took sides with Israel, voting against a ceasefire motion at the United Nations General Assembly. Other Pacific countries abstained. And just weeks before that vote, Israel's President Benjamin Netanyahu had a private meeting with several Pacific leaders, including the head of the Pacific Islands Forum, the regional body of Pacific governments.
I can tell you quite openly that last September, in the margins of the UN, I had a very fruitful meeting, along with some of our leaders, with President Netanyahu. He offered help with our fisheries, our ocean management, with our water issues, agriculture, promising to send a high-level delegation of officials that are experts in those areas to see how they can help the Pacific.
Israel's diplomatic relationship with Pacific countries dates as far back as the late 70s, providing millions of dollars in aid and infrastructure development. In 2012, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru and Palau voted against giving Palestine non-member observer status in the UN.
As a result, the Israeli president invited them over and promised them aid and so forth. Israel has been busy with its diplomatic maneuvering around the Pacific as well.
The big player countries like Israel, the US and China all playing a political game of chess in the Pacific. As Israel ambassadors told Samoa, the world has a vested interest in the Pacific.
Hello, Falava. Shalom.
We're talking about, almost 20 votes in the UN, voting bloc. If you get that, then you're able to get what you want. If you control the Pacific, then strategically and militarily, you have a lot of influence in the biggest ocean in the world.
There's an abiding friendship between Samoa and Israel, and we greet you here as a friend.
Citizens from countries like Samoa, Tonga, and Fiji are among those who enjoy visa-free travel to Israel, and vice versa for Israeli citizens wanting to visit those Pacific countries. Israel has put in a bid to become a dialogue member of the Pacific Islands Forum. It's a position that would increase its influence and lobbying power. Last year, Papua New Guinea became the fifth country to launch an embassy in Israel. The Israeli government has also committed to bankrolling a Fiji embassy in Israel too.
The setting up of the embassy by Fiji and Papua New Guinea is a concrete manifestation of the diplomatic engagement taking place. So you're going to see more of that in the future. You're going to see Israel being more active in the future in the Pacific.
And as Israel's presence in the Pacific continues to grow, so too is the political and religious divide among Pacific people on both sides of the Israel-Hamas conflict.
What is the Pacific Islands Forum's position amidst the ongoing conflict in Israel?
We are a region of peace, and we want to keep it that way. We are friends to all and enemy to no one.
These images of Pacific people are a far cry from that friendly position.
The reason why I support Palestine is because, first and foremost, I'm a human being. I care about people. I care about what's happening and the massive death toll currently happening in Gaza.
Michelle Mulipola's great-grandfather, Karauna Mata'utia Solomona, was secretary for the Mau movement almost 100 years ago, a political movement that fought for liberation against the New Zealand administration in Samoa.
I find that Palestine's fight today was Samoa's fight yesterday. And so in honouring my great-grandfather and his legacy of freedom fighting, I felt compelled to kind of stand up for Palestine.
Mulipola is frustrated by the pull of religion across the Pacific.
I, like many of my people, recognise the Jews as the indigenous people of Israel.
First and foremost, I think they're Polynesians. They're upholding colonial standards. They're upholding white supremacy. They're upholding imperialism and capitalism and all of those things wrapped up in colonialism.
There's the narrative that Jews are colonizers. Absolutely not. We are going back 3,000 years. The Jews, that's their homeland.
Our people supporting Israel through thick and thin is wrapped up in this false idea that it's about religion. And wrapped up in that is Islamophobia, which is rampant amongst our people, especially the very religious.
Some of the beliefs, say the Pacific, that the Pacific people are descendants of the lost tribe of Israel. It's very easy to use the political leveraging mechanism to mobilize support around those ideas of being indigenous and linked to Israel.
Kulam avotai gam ken.
Israel's ambassador, Ran Yacobi, declined an interview with Q&A, but his influence isn't going unnoticed, writing op-eds for major Pacific newspapers like the Samoa Observer. Last year, Yacobi wrote to the Samoa National Council of Churches, asking for Samoan church leaders to pray over the situation in Israel.
Are you concerned about any influence Israel may have over the Pacific region?
No, I'm not concerned at all. Again, how national governments choose their diplomacy and their statecraft, how they choose to engage with any particular country. Again, that's a sovereign decision for each country to make.
You've been wonderful friends of Israel. Israel is your friend.
We are friends to all and enemy to no one.
Indira Stewart with that report. There are more details on her story at onenews.co.nz. Hey, Akoene, Q&A is back after the break. Hoki mai, welcome back. Just before we finish today, on Friday, TVNZ announced it's proposing to cut Sunday Fair Go, some of the re-news team in both the midday and tonight news bulletins, along with other roles both inside and outside the newsroom. The news came a little over a week after Warner Brothers Discovery announced its plans to end all News Hub operations. We had hoped to speak to the broadcasting minister about the situation, but she declined our interview request for the third consecutive week. She sent us a statement, which she also provided other media, saying there is a range of work underway to support a modern and sustainable media industry, and she will take a paper to Cabinet shortly. We hope to speak with her soon. For now, though, kua matu. That is Q&A for this week. From the Q&A team, thanks for watching. Ngā mihi ki a koutou I ngā karere. Thanks for your feedback. Hey Te Rā Wiki. We'll see you next Sunday at 9 a.m.
Q&A is made with the support of New Zealand On Air.